Welcome to Feminist Money. My name's Kate, and this is the podcast that combines finance and feminism. We'll be covering four stories on the podcast, including end of the Women's Equality Party. Why is the Women's Equality Party facing a final sunset? American president election incoming. Is America ready for its first potential woman president? See the person, not the stereotype. What is the impact of ageism for women? And woman of the week, Lilly Ledbetter of the Fair Pay Act. And on that note, onward with the podcast. For our first story, why is the Women's Equality Party facing its final sunset? Now, I personally got really excited and a bit sad at the same time when I saw this story. I personally connect to it because I went to the very feminist college of Cambridge, the first women's college, Newnham College, Cambridge. I sound like I'm on a famous quiz show. I went to Cambridge on a full scholarship thanks to that combo of support, work and luck, and I will always, always appreciate that opportunity. I was at Cambridge when one of the most polished Cantab alumni, Sandy Toxvey, came to speak to us at the Women's Equality Party. I was a student. I had been up late the night before and I had a very puffy face that looked like I'd been stung by a bee repeatedly and not in a good way. But I still had a photo with Sandy because it's Sandy Toxvey. If you've ever watched Bake Off or QI, you'll know that celebrity pull that people like Sandy have. And it's that appeal of celebrity that actually helped the Women's Equality Party, not just because of the selfies I took, but because when the party projected a suffragette slogan, deeds not words, on the UK Houses of Parliament, and the police showed up, they saw Sandy, their request was for a selfie rather than an ID check. And it does feel sad the Women's Equality Party is calling it a day, but everyone seems to be on board. The party's leader, Mandy Reid, and the co-founders, Sandy Toxvey and Catherine Mayer, are advocating for the closure of the Women's Equality Party ahead of a party member decision in 2 weeks. We know that because in advance of the decision, the co-founders wrote an opinion piece on The Guardian setting out the reasons for calling it a day. I find it a really feminist piece in how they articulate their vision. They set out to found a political party that was going to challenge the current political system rather than become another part of it. And that included helping elect women councillors in boroughs or towns across the UK. Their aim was they wanted to show that there were votes in feminism, hoping that the major parties would mimic them, including writing a label on their manifestos, encouraging parties to take their ideas. And because they campaigned with women candidates, major parties did the same. The Women's Equality Party also supported Mandy Reid to become the first woman of colour to lead a UK political party. Their operating model wasn't the kind of competition-based model you see in most major politics today, I would say. Their operating model was to work with other parties to craft policy platforms like universal free childcare. As soon as I hear that policy, my ears prick up. It sounds incredible. The idea that more women would be enabled to work if they want to without childcare taking up most of their pay packet. It's ideas like that that get you excited for this party. And this is partly what's prompted the Women's Equality Party closure. In the words of its co-founders, the election of Keir Starmer's Labour Party is a leadership which doesn't listen to its MPs, let alone the Women's Equality Party. They underscore this difference, as while the Women's Equality Party view care as an investment, the current Labour Party see it as an expense to be cut. However you feel about the Labour Party, that is the view of the Women's Equality Party. It's also a story about money, and their opinion piece does not mince its words in stating that money has always been a problem, because most of the party's income comes from the members who, I'll use their words, have already been cash-strapped before the 1-2 punch of the pandemic and the cost of living crisis. God, they're amazing writers. There is a fantastic story on money in this party, because when a future major donor had one request when granting them a life-altering sum of money that could take the Women's Equality Party to the stratosphere, the request, I really like what you're doing. But remove one word, women. Thankfully, they turned down that donor. That is a feminist act in of itself, to deny yourself funding because it would set back the advocacy of rights for women. Pankhurst would have been proud. So what's next? The Women's Equality Party's upcoming conference in mid-November will decide on next steps, including if the sunset call is to be heeded. And I'm actually really interested most in what comes after mid-November. Feminists have been fighting for power in different movements for generations, for decades, and in the words of its co-founders, We must do more, not less, to confront the storm. Far from giving up the fight for equality, the two of us, like many activists, are hard at work on ways to gear up, to regroup, to renew, and to return roaring. For our second story, is America ready for its first woman president? Now, I have really tried not to make each week about the American presidency race because if you're listening in America, firstly, welcome. I went to America last month and I loved the Americans I met. I'm also now a Starbucks convert, and that is so, so difficult for an Australian coffee snob to say. But I also know from being there that the election was everywhere. In fact, on my way to Starbucks, I was dodging voting signs or call flutes, including seeing them disappear and be replaced day to day. And seeing Kamala Harris and the commentary around her, that made me hark back actually to 8 years ago, when we also had a female candidate running for president. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton ran against the same Republican candidate. You could say that Clinton was arguably more established in the public consciousness in terms of time that she spent in the public eye, but that also gave her competitors more barbs to use against her, including that email controversy where her use of a private server while Secretary of State led to that perception of dishonesty. Harris doesn't really have the same controversy attached to her. And voters in 2024 are in a very different position from those in 2016, in that they've already seen a presidency by the same Republican candidate running again. The question that comes to mind is whether voters have also changed how they view gender and their president. If Kamala Harris is elected, she would be the first woman president. And political science research published in The Conversation indicates that American voters do see women as more synonymous with political leadership and as more effective than men as politicians. And on the topic of leadership, you could argue that Harris might be a better fit for the role as someone who understands the political situation of 2024 because she's there, she's been the VP for the past 4 years. It's a feminist issue because whether America is ready for a woman president speaks to the heart of gender stereotypes. It would be the first woman in the role and challenge the stereotypes we might hold consciously or unconsciously about women in America. The gender stereotypes we had of past female candidates of not being warm or mean or cold, that would be flipped in one instance to being ambitious, strong, and presidential. When we hear media commentary that focuses on whether or not Kamala Harris is allowed to laugh and whether it's a presidential laugh, that's what I mean by a gender stereotype in action, because we would never question a male candidate in the same way. It's stereotypes like this that women must navigate, how to be strong and presidential in your behaviours without running the risk of being cold and mean because you're not acting as we expect women to act. But unlike 8 years ago, Harris also benefits from more women stepping up to challenge these stereotypes, with more American women winning political office in this decade than any other previously, including Congress numbers expanding from 90 to 145 since 2009. In short, we are seeing more women in political leadership and taking it on in different ways due to having more women in those roles coming from different backgrounds. And more women now head to Washington to represent their constituency in Congress. It is becoming normal to have a diverse gender and background for your representatives. It's an issue of money because not only is the presidential role arguably very well paid at $400,000 US per year plus expenses, but they also receive a pension of over half that amount each year. I don't know about you, but getting paid $230,000, that's the going rate right now for the presidential pension. Getting paid that just to exist every year for serving a role once, and then top that up with the book deals and the speaking gigs that most former presidents embark on the moment they step out of the Oval Office. It's also decision-making power to shape the financial future for the country, including for its women. Granted, not all women are feminists, and there is debate about whether Kamala is one, but I would say that a woman has a better chance of being a feminist, and from what we've seen, seems more likely to make decisions in line with feminism, because unlike her competitor, she has lived experience of what it is like to be a woman, and unlike her presidential rival, she doesn't think it's acceptable to say that she would be entitled to go and grab another woman's body. Whether or not America is ready for its first woman president will be determined next week, and I will be very interested in the result, because while it may not be my president, What is unspoken in this conversation is that America does still shape the rest of the world, and a step forward for feminists in America would have a ripple effect globally on so many women. For our campaign story this week, what is the impact of ageism for women? That question is at the heart of a new awareness campaign, See the Person, Not the Stereotype. It's a campaign in Australia focused on challenging stereotypes of professionals over the age of 50. First focused on women, it's particularly looking at recruitment and stopping businesses from discriminating against older professionals, and also stopping self-limiting beliefs that mean we don't put ourselves forward for opportunities because of ageism, because of stereotypes around age. This specific campaign came about when communications and job search specialist Sue Parker posed the challenge on LinkedIn for women to post a photo of themselves alongside their age. And women responded, women including journalist Tracy Spicer and eSafety Commissioner Julie Inman Grant. They took part in the campaign. Now, to give them full credit, the idea behind the campaign was inspired by a similar one in the US, launched by a California-based agency, Grace Collective. They adopted a hashtag instead, hashtag age is not just a number. And their campaign aimed to challenge the perception of what age means for women over 50. Because in their words, every single year of wisdom, perspective, and triumph counts. It also comes at a time when research suggests that ageism is very much alive in countries like Australia. The World Health Organization showed that a third of Australians over the age of 50 experience age discrimination at work and in relation to jobs like application processes. The Australian HR Institute and the Australian Human Rights Commission also released data that showed last year only half or 56% of HR personnel were actually open to hiring people age 50 to 64, and a fifth of HR people, the people who managed the recruitment process, said they weren't that open or open at all to hiring older workers. I'm just thinking about their decision-making process and the fact that they feel like they can be so open about their ageism. That's pretty shocking about the culture. If people working in HR are actively engaging in ageism when screening CVs and managing interviews, and if they can speak about it with that unabashed confidence that a fifth of people say they wouldn't be open or not open at all to hiring professionals, good professionals, just because they're over the age of 50, that has a direct impact on the older women who are actively discriminated against when they might apply to new roles or apply for promotions. It has a direct impact on their ability to earn income during their working life. So you might say, working life, Kate, perhaps it's time for them to consider retiring. Please don't actually say that. I'm saying it to devil's advocate myself, but no, it's someone's choice whether or not they retire. We don't say that. And that retirement dream, that might not be an easy an option as we assume it is, as data published by the Women's Gender Equality Agency in Australia, viewed in 2019, shows that pension or superannuation gaps between men and women over the age of 50 are, get ready for this because it's a very big number, it's a 40% gender gap. That's data from 2017 that was viewed in 2019, so one hopes it's changed, but I doubt it's changed significantly from 40%. The fact there's a gap at all is fairly shocking. So the impact of ageism is a money issue we need to grapple with as feminists because it directly impacts the lifestyle and opportunities that women can afford now and into the future. Now I'm going to level with you. That tone I took of why don't they just retire, that's because I've actually seen some women in action under the age of 50 be quite dismissive of ageism. And to them, I say this, invest in a good watch and start watching because ageism one day will be an issue you face if you don't stand up for women now. In short, by tackling ageism for your mother and grandmother, you are also tackling that issue for yourself and your daughter. And if you can whoop for the Helen Mirrens of this world, and I don't blame you, that woman is incredible. But make sure you also whoop for the women working alongside you in your office who don't have the same capital behind them, but are no less deserving of a whoop when they go for a promotion if they're capable and they can do the job and they need support to ensure that ageism is called out and stamped out like the cockroach on our collective feminist shoes. Can I get a whoop? And finally, here's a feminist you should know. This week, we're celebrating Lilly Ledbetter of the Fair Pay Act. This is a new section of the show, and it came about because I was hit by the passing of a few women recently who made such an impact as women who fought for other women, as feminists in our community, and whose background, I need to be really honest with you, I did not know the extent of, and whose actions we have to thank for why we are in the position we are today. So in short, I was motivated to recognize and thank the women who have gone before us across the world to make concepts like feminist money possible. So who was Lilly Ledbetter? Well, Lilly was described by Barack Obama as someone who never set out to be a household name. She just wanted to be paid the same as a man for her hard work. Lilly's story comes to us from Alabama, where she worked at the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Plant. They're that company that makes tires for cars, trucks, lorries, etc. Lilly, in her own words, came from one of the poorest counties in Alabama, but was taught by her parents that if you did a good day's work, you would be paid well for what you had done. When she went to work at Goodyear, she was told never to discuss pay, and if she ever did discuss pay, she would lose her job. In short, as no one ever talked about pay, she had no idea how her pay compared to her peers. Lilly was therefore surprised to be dropped an anonymous note one day, where she learned that she wasn't being paid the same as her peers. She was being paid less, a lot less, for doing exactly the same job as her male colleagues. And that pay slip affected everything: her base salary, her overtime, and her retirement fund savings. And that's what makes the timing of the anonymous note's reveal so painful. Lilly was 2 years away from retirement. It's painful because retirement savings are a percentage of your pay packet, and so the decision of Goodyear to pay her less than her male colleagues for the same role didn't just impact her current options, they would impact the conditions of her retirement. Lilly Ledbetter decided to sue her employer, but the case wasn't resolved until 9 years later, when in 2007, the US Supreme Court said she had filed her lawsuit too late. They said that Lilly should have launched a complaint sooner, and by sooner, I mean within 6 months of her company first paying her a different wage to her co-workers, even though she didn't know about it for nearly 2 decades. And if she had tried to discuss pay with her co-workers, it seemed like she wouldn't have a job to compare it to. That Supreme Court decision meant that Lilly did not win. She didn't get her pay packet, she did not get her damages. And that was from a company who decided that spending money in court was worth more than paying people the same wage for the same work. The fact that they would rather spend money on legal fees rather than paying their workers makes you think. How many similar companies are making profits from people not knowing how much their colleagues are paid, so they are denied the information needed to effectively negotiate? When I hear that, I am so frustrated on Lilly's behalf. When you think about how much she would have accrued in legal fees in the 9 years her employer fought her in court, only to be told by the US Supreme Court that essentially she either should have made a time machine, become the new Doctor Who traveling companion, or she should have not followed company procedures and culture that pay was not to be discussed. Well, luckily, I wasn't the only one who felt for Lilly. And fortunately for the women of the world, Lilly didn't give up. Lilly worked on the Ledbetter bill immediately after the verdict so that, in her words, future generations would have the same option to file a charge if they were being discriminated against by their employer. Barack Obama, the serving president of the day, signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Restoration Act as his first approval of legislation and said, "This one's for Lilly." That Fair Pay Act has made it easier for workers to sue after discovering that they were being discriminated against through pay, an opportunity that was denied to Lilly. Remember that timing issue the Supreme Court flagged? The court said she was not entitled to back pay because her complaint had not been lodged within 6 months of the discrimination first taking place. Well, 2 years later, the Fair Pay Act in her name would ensure that that decision did not impact on any women in the future. I wanted to give the last word to Lilly and her address at the Democratic National Convention 12 years ago. I was shortchanged, but this fight became bigger than Lilly Ledbetter. Today, it's about my daughter. It's about my granddaughter. It's about women and men. It's about families. It's about equality and justice. Lilly left a legacy as an equal pay advocate who inspired the Fair Pay Act of 2009. She passed away earlier this month on 14th of October, but had told the pastor that at her funeral, she wanted one last line to represent her. That line? She made a difference.
So thank you to Lily Ledbetter, a feminist you should know.
And that's the episode for this week of Feminist Money. If you would like to learn more about the stories we've discussed, including our Woman of the Week, these stories will be detailed in the episode description. And if you have a great story that you'd like to share, please just head over to feministmoney.com.au and the contact page. I would love to hear from you. I've been Kate. This has been Feminist Money. And onwards, my gorgeous feminist friends.